Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining us today. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Much has been said and written about mafia culture in and around New York City in the early to mid-20th century. Dramatized over the years in film and TV, you probably know the names of many of the colorful and menacing criminals, John Gotti, Lucky Luciano. When the TV show Boardwalk Empire followed such a storyline, there was a minor character featured, a black woman lawyer who was part of a group tasked with taking down the mob. Now, on the TV show's web fan boards, people commented that this wasn't possible. That woman would even be there. No such person could exist. Well, she did. She really did. And it is her story that is told in the new book, Invisible, the forgotten story of the black woman lawyer who took down America's most powerful mobster. It was written by my guest, Professor Stephen L. Carter. Professor Carter is the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Law at Yale Law School and is the author of 16 books, including 6 novels. But this book is special. It's about his grandmother, Eunice Hunton Carter, who at 36 years old helped take down one of the most notorious crime bosses in New York, Lucky Luciano. Professor Carter, welcome to All of It.
Thank you, Allison. It's a real pleasure to be here.
So before you wrote this book and you went down the research rabbit hole, what did you know about your grandmother's career and about her life?
And my grandmother died when I was in high school, and in those days, I knew her mainly as this stern, intimidating woman who was always correcting our grammar or telling us we were using the wrong fork at dinner. I knew very little about these stories. Later on, I began to hear more and more about them. I began to understand the work she'd done as a prosecutor, the work she'd done taking down, as you said, like Luciano. And I finally decided to put other things aside and write a book about it. And fortunately, my daughter, Leah, who's a practicing lawyer in New York, was willing to take some time off and be my principal researcher. And the result was this book.
So it's interesting, this book. In one way, I alluded to in the intro that she was a unicorn in a way because she was this woman lawyer in the middle of all these men on this big case. But at the same time, she was very much a product of her culture at the time and what the sort of middle-class, educated black culture of that time. Can you explain that to our listeners?
You know, we live in a time when a lot of people, especially people of color, a lot of women, and certainly a lot of women of color, feel these great barriers going up. They're worried about progress, and is progress going to stop or reverse? But Eunice lived at a time when the barriers were much higher and were official, and here she was, this black woman living in Harlem, born in Atlanta, believing that she could be a lawyer and be successful in a time when you could count on your fingers the number of successful black lawyers, black women lawyers in the United States. A lot of this was due to her upbringing. Her own parents were educated people. They'd been big activists, and they'd raised their children, Eunice and her younger brother, to believe that they could do anything they wanted to do.
She went on to graduate from Smith College, surely one of the earliest black graduates. She became a writer. She wrote book reviews. When did she first become interested in the law?
We don't know exactly. We do know that her family left Atlanta after the Atlanta riot of 1906, when furious white mobs swarmed the black business district, burning black businesses and later going after black homes. And a year later, after they moved to Brooklyn, she was in New Jersey in the summer at the beach, and she met a little boy there who asked her what she wanted to be when she grew up, and she said she wanted to be a lawyer, and he asked her why, and she said because she wanted to put the bad people in jail. Hmm. So that was Eunice at 8 or 9 years old. It's true that she had some false starts along the way before she finally decided to go to law school. But I do think that there's something to that, that there was a part of her that always believed in being part of whatever forces there were that got justice done in America.
And where did she go to law school and how did she fare?
She went to Fordham Law School in New York City. This was at a time when the big law schools, most of them did not admit women. And although they didn't have formal bars against admitting people of color, there were very, very few black students who were ever admitted. But the urban law schools, particularly the Catholic law schools, had a mission, you might say, at the time To educate women, Catholics, Jews, immigrants, people who were denied admission, never even the chance at regular law schools. I should add, by the way, that the big, well-known law schools did their best to shut down as many of those urban law schools as they could. And she did very well at Fordham, although she did have to take some time off when she fell ill midway in her first year. After she graduated, she hung out a shingle in Harlem, and at first didn't do very well. It was hard for a black woman to get clients, but of course things moved along.
At what point did she become get on the radar, I should say, of Special Prosecutor Dewey?
So Dewey was appointed Special Prosecutor for Organized Crime in 1935 in the summer because of a growing sense among municipal reformers that the city was so corrupt that the regular New York prosecutor couldn't go after organized crime. And this is true. It was quite corrupt. And Tom Dewey, the prosecutor, was a Republican. Eunice was a Republican. She had done some things for the party. This may have been part of how she got on his radar. There had also been a riot in Harlem in 1935, and Eunice had been the secretary of, and therefore the public face, of the commission appointed by the mayor to understand the causes of the riot. And at that point, she took a lot of bullets, figuratively, for the party. But Dewey's story was always different. Dewey always said that he hired her simply because he interviewed her and that she blew him away in the interview. We don't know exactly the details of what happened, but that sounds entirely plausible.
I would love for you to read on page 107 this description, because it really encompasses how unique and what an accomplishment it was for her to get where she was at this point in her career.
I'm happy to do that. It is difficult to say exactly what Dewey expected of Eunice when she first joined his team. Certainly, there were whispers in the press that she was a mere token, although nobody dared use the word. Instead, the newspapers wrote about her hiring as a payoff to Harlem's Negroes, as if Dewey had hired 19 white men on merit and one black woman because he had to. Dewey himself always insisted that he offered Eunice a place because of her excellence, and perhaps that was the truth. From Eunice's point of view, however, the motivation behind her hiring was irrelevant. Even if the rumors were true, she was hardly the sort to allow herself to be shunted aside and then trotted out from time to time for public display. A calm determination formed part of her inheritance. The family in which she had been forged was notable for its fortitude. Her enslaved grandfather had escaped not once, not twice, but three times, then persuaded his vicious owner to set him free. Her father had stood up to a white railway conductor at the height of Jim Crow. Her mother had traveled alone through Klan country. The family was conservative and traditionalist, but these traits did not lead to passivity or acceptance. Huntons fought back. They did not tolerate either insult or offense, but believed that both could be met successfully by perseverance and persuasion. They believed that the darker nation could do fine on its own if whites would just get out of their way.
We're speaking with Professor Stephen L. Carter about his new book, Invisible, The Forgotten Story of the Black Woman Lawyer Who Took Down America's Most Powerful Mobster. Did your grandmother's appointment make the papers? I understand that it made some headlines.
It did. That when Dewey was appointed, he hired his 20 young lawyers. They were immediately labeled by the press 20 against the underworld. That was the phrase you saw everywhere, 20 against the underworld. It was 19 white men and Eunice. And the headlines from New York to California put in that Eunice had been hired. That is, they said, Dewey hires Negro. If you look at the New York Times, for example, for that date, that's exactly what it said. It says, Dewey hires Mrs. Carter, a Negro. that was the headline. It was a kind of man-bites-dog story, and people were perplexed. They weren't sure quite what to expect. But remarkably, Eunice's hiring and then her role in developing the evidence that actually put Lucky Luciano behind bars ended up making her one of the most famous black women in America for a period of about 10 years.
What did Eunice see her role as? What did she see as her job when she was part of this commission?
Eunice was a prosecutor, and that she was hired to prosecute. She expected to do the same work as the others, but that's not what happened. That initially, Dewey assigned 19 white men in the office to look into things like loan sharking and racketeering and drug smuggling and murder, what Dewey used to call a real crime. Whereas Eunice, the only one on the team who was not a white male, was assigned to look into, get ready for it, prostitution. Dewey had made clear that he was not going to try a prostitution case. He was not a vice crusader. But nevertheless, it turned out that once he hung out his shingle, once Dewey did, New Yorkers were interested in cleaning up prostitution in their neighborhoods. So he had to assign someone to it. So he assigned Eunice. And she would meet with all these people who came in and complained, answer their letters. And eventually, she began to put together the evidence that no one else had believed in, the evidence that prostitution was indeed a mob-controlled activity, which all the experts at the time, particularly the white men who ran the office, thought wasn't true.
So what were the patterns she noticed?
So there were a couple of different things. One was that whenever there was a raid, and there weren't very many, on a brothel, that the women were released almost immediately. Second, there was one lawyer in particular whose clients always seemed to be released or were always had the charges dropped. None of the women ever went to jail, nor did any of the men, I suppose we would now call them pimps. They had dignified themselves at the time with the term bookers. That's what they were called. She also noticed that the women traveled back and forth and were used as employees at different brothels, women who worked in the trade. But most important, Eunice did something that other investigators had never bothered to do. She talked to the women. She tried to understand their stories, how they've been forced into this life. And in talking to them and gaining their trust, she began to put together little tidbits they'd heard here and there about how much money they paid each week for protection, for example, or bits and pieces of what they heard gangsters say to each other. And that was how she began to put together the picture, by paying attention to the women, listening to the stories they told.
That's what we call a cliffhanger, because we're going to go to a quick break. We're speaking with Stephen L. Carter about his new book, Invisible. We'll be right back. This is All of It on WNYC. You're listening to All of It with Allison Stewart, and we're back with Professor Stephen L. Carter, who's written a new book called Invisible, The Forgotten Story of the Black Woman Lawyer Who Took Down America's Most Powerful Mobster. And Steve, I have to tell you, it's not only is it a great history book, it's also a page-turner. It's really great. It's really interesting to watch how this all unfolded, this taking down of the mob. In terms of writing, did you think about that?
Well, of course, any writer's flattered to be told that a book is a page-turner, so I appreciate that. But it's not so much my skill, it's the story itself. That is, mm-hmm. the story itself is a remarkable one and has its own momentum, because not only is it the story of the prosecution of a mobster who is believed to be untouchable, like Luciano, but it's also the story of this black woman who was shunted aside in the office where she worked, who alone and against the odds, against everyone's expectations, developed the evidence that actually led to Luciano being indicted, when none of the other men in the office, the white men who were looking into loan sharking and murder and so on, none of them could ever connect him to an actual crime. And Eunice could. She was the only one who did, and it took her a while to do it, and it took her even longer to persuade the powers that be, including Dewey himself, that she actually had a case.
How did she do it? How did she persuade Dewey?
So she went to see Dewey, and she brought with her a lawyer named Murray Griffine, who eventually became a very distinguished federal judge, and told him about interviews with the women who worked in the prostitution trade, and the information she'd put together about the amounts that they paid and protection and so on and so on, as well as things she'd overheard, or things, I'm sorry, that they had overheard and told her about, suggesting that Lucky Luciano was at the top of all this. And very reluctantly, Dewey allowed her to do some wiretaps that developed more evidence, and eventually allowed her to organize a raid where the police raided 40 brothels at once. The women were arrested. They were brought in. They were all placed in Eunice's care. There were over 100 women who were arrested. And they waited to be released, because part of their deal with the mob was that they would be bailed out. But the fixers, the people charged with bailing them out, had all been arrested the day before. It eventually dawned on the women that they were in for the long haul unless they turned against higher-ups, which with a lot of coaching and assistance from Eunice, several of them eventually did.
So that giant raid, it happened, I think, on February 1st, 1936. How did this tactic contribute to ensuring that the mafia was caught unprepared?
Well, the point was to hit all of these places at once because the police force was so corrupt that if there'd been any time lag at all, the people involved would have been warned. And so, in fact, the police who did the raids were not from the vice squad. They were brought out in the middle of the night. They were not told why they were being brought to particular locations. They weren't told until 5 minutes of 9 p.m., and the raids were set for 9, exactly what their instructions were. So it's organized with an almost paranoid concern for the security of the operation, but that was really the way you had to work in New York in the 1930s, which really was a fixed town.
Was Eunice a part of the prosecution?
So you have to imagine that here's this woman in the office who had done all of the work, rounded up the witnesses, put together the evidence, established the chart and timetable of how prostitution in New York worked and what its connection to the mob was, and laid out the actual connections. But when it came time to try the case, Dewey chose three white men to try the case with him. Eunice was still in the courtroom a lot. She was still in charge of the welfaring, as I believe it was called, of the women. They were in her care, especially the four who were witnesses against Luciano, whose protection was up to her. But she was not given any role in the trial.
Do we know how she felt about that choice?
Well, Eunice was always the sort who thought, if they give you lemons, make lemonade. She was not a complainer at all. That if she was given a job duty and if her job was to protect these women and make sure they had apartments to stay in and police to guard them and so on, then she was going to do the best possible job at that and move on to the next case.
We're speaking with Stephen Carter. He wrote the book Invisible, The Forgotten Story of the Black Woman Lawyer Who Took Down America's Most Powerful Mobster. She was also someone very well known in the community. And then after this trial, she was famous. She became kind of a celebrity. What did she do with this newfound political capital?
So she did become a celebrity, not just in the black community, but also she was profiled in Life magazine. She got honorary degrees. She was on television and so on. Television, of course, is new technology. She was on the radio and so on. And she became a popular speaker. She was invited to give a lot of talks about various things, and she chose a cause. She talked about the trial. She talked about justice issues. But she also talked about what we now call sexual harassment. She talked about it at a time when no one else was discussing this, when you were supposed to be happy just to have a job, especially if you're a woman. Remember, this is the midst of the Depression. She called the treatment of women in the workplace, and I quote, one of the most vicious things in our economic and social order. She talked about, and we're talking in the 1930s, remember, she talked about men who extracted what she called relations of an intimate nature from women in return for continued employment. And she said, boiling in oil is a little too good for that kind of man. She spoke about these issues and other justice issues as well at a time when not only was there great silence about them, most people, I think, didn't recognize that this was an issue at all.
One of the things that I described in the book is that you have this one vein, which is this page-turner mob case, and then you have the story of her life. And we shouldn't say that it wasn't an easy life. She did have come from some means and from some stature, but she had difficulties during the course of her life. And she and her brother, they became estranged. Can you tell folks why?
It's true that Eunice spent 10 years as a prosecutor, because after Dewey was the special prosecutor, he became elected New York prosecutor. She spent 10 years in the prosecutor's office, did very, very well there, and also frequently campaigned for Republican candidates, including Dewey when he ran for president. You have to remember, this is back in the days when the Republicans were the party of civil rights. And she expected certain rewards to come her way, and in particular, she always longed for a judgeship. More than anything else, she wanted to be a judge. And she never got to be a judge. And nowadays, looking back on it, we would talk about race, we would talk about gender, we would talk about the intersection of race and gender. But for Eunice, it was because of her brother. Eunice's brother, her younger brother, Alpheus, was a communist. And I don't mean that he was a man who was falsely accused of communism during the McCarthy era. I mean, he was a real communist, a genuine communist, a supporter of Stalin, a high-ranking member of the party, a man who did favors for the Soviet embassy and probably for Soviet intelligence. As well. He had an FBI file 700 pages long. And Eunice, not only did they grow estranged, Eunice grew very bitter toward him. She believed that it was his communism that kept her from getting some of the rewards that she thought were rightly hers, given the work that she'd done both in the prosecutor's office and for the party. And she was probably right. That probably did play an enormous role. And in 1951, her brother Alpheus actually went to prison for contempt of court, for refusing to name names. And Eunice by that time had left the prosecutor's office and was in private practice as a trial lawyer. But Alpheus did not go to her for help, and I don't think she would have given help if it had been offered. She never visited him in prison, and my father always said that they never spoke again.
I want to circle back to the top of the interview for my last question. I mentioned, because I heard you tell this story, about the person who said this woman couldn't possibly exist, who wrote that on a comment board for Boardwalk Empire. Why do you think that person wrote that?
Because people don't know these stories.
Right.
People honestly don't know. People don't understand that the history of Black America, like the history of America itself, is enormously complicated. And I think it's so important to uncover these stories of people who achieved remarkable things. And what makes it unbelievable to people is precisely that it's remarkable. And since you asked the question, I'll tell you one other thing. I had lunch with Terrence Winter, the creator of Boardwalk Empire, who told me that the character in Boardwalk Empire, the unnamed Black woman who was a prosecutor where the fans didn't believe it, that actually was indeed patterned on my grandmother, Eunice Carter.
The name of the book is Invisible, The Forgotten Story of the Black Woman Lawyer Who Took Down America's Most Powerful Mobster. Stephen Carter, it was a pleasure speaking with you.
It was great being on. Thanks so much.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart, and joining me in studio now is Clemency Burton Hill, WNYC's Creative Director for Music and Arts. Her new book, Year of Wonder, Classical Music to Enjoy Day by Day. Clemmy's collected a classical piece of music, one piece for every day of the year, and with an accompanying anecdote or backstory. Clemmy joins us every Monday to tell us about a couple of pieces we can expect to find in the book for the current week and to play us some music. Hi, Clemmy.
Hi, Allison.
All right, so we're talking Purcell, Defala, and Barber.
Yeah, we have a bit of a musical mix this week. I wanted to include Henry Purcell. He's one of the English greats, my homeboy, if you like. He was born in 1659, and he actually died on the day that I include this piece of music, which is the 21st of November. So this would be music for Wednesday, if you're following along with the book Year of Wonder. And this is kind of the ultimate lament. So pretty fitting for the day that he died. It's When I Am Laid in Earth, and it comes as Dido in his opera Dido and Aeneas is Dying. And there are all sorts of musically technical reasons why I think this piece really seems to have universal resonance. And I could get nerdy about it, but actually...
Let's get nerdy.
Should we get nerdy. Super nerdy?
Let's
Passus
do it.
Passus Duriusculus. How about that, Alison Stewart? That basically means ground bass. It means a loop. So if you think about any contemporary hip-hop producer or pop producer, anyone who's essentially building a track over a repeating bass line or a loop is emulating what Purcell was doing all those years ago. And this particular loop goes kind of downwards. It descends into despair. And then instead of fitting the tune, which is really sort of beautiful and plangent and lamenting, as you might expect, instead of fitting that over what you'd expect it to do, he actually extends it over the top over a 9-bar phrase. So instead of a 5-bar phrase, mm-hmm. which is what the bass line is doing, he sends the soprano soaring over. And that kind of wrong-foots us. And that in itself is kind of interesting because we're expecting something to happen and it doesn't quite happen. So our, you know, expectations are being set up and then completely confounded, which is always interesting in music generally. And then there's this just yearning, wrenching melodic line. And if you listen to what she's saying, it's so human, it's so mortal. She's just saying, when I'm laid in earth, remember me.
So sad. He did not live long.
I know. He's one of the absolute titans of all music, really, but he was very young. Like so many composers, mm-hmm. you know, I was actually thinking about this for something else recently. There are so many composers who die young, and you think of that in the pop music canon. You think of all those people dead at 27, and there are so many in the classical world too, so many geniuses that were cut off before their time. Speaking of people being born, though, that's a happy one for the 23rd of November, Manuel de Falla. And he was a fantastic Spanish composer born on the 23rd of November in 1876. I've chosen a piece that is a real postcard, a love letter for his native Spain, although he actually wrote this when he was living in Paris in around 1914. And he'd been in Paris for a while at that point. He was hanging out with the absolute creme de la creme of the musical It crowd, the hipsters of the day, if you like, Debussy, Ravel, Stravinsky.
Oh, those guys.
Just those guys, casually hanging out with Stravinsky. Those are the guys who are really shaking the tree when it comes to what classical music is. And what's interesting about de Falla is he's incorporating all of that. He's really interested in those trends. He's definitely, mm-hmm. you know, pushing the boundaries as well, but he never loses sight of his roots. And actually, within a year of writing this piece, he would have returned to his native Madrid. And I just love this. This is a real, puts a spring in your step. If you need a dose of Spanish sunshine on the 23rd of November here in New York City, I hope this might do the trick.
So it's called Siete Canciones Populares Españolas.
It is indeed. And I'm so glad that you said that, not mine. Your pronunciation was absolutely perfect.
7 Spanish folk songs. It's funny that this piece of classical music is considered folk music, I
Absolutely.
Guess in some way.
Absolutely. Well, that is so interesting that you pick up on that, because so many of our greatest classical composers are actually emulating and repeating what they're hearing on the streets. Mm. And folk music plays a huge part in classical music. And what I wanted to do with the book, as we discussed in previous weeks, is really tear down all those barriers to entry, tear down some of those ideas around classical music, that it's this very refined and elite thing that only, you know, is the preserve of certain people with the right education or background or skin colour or whatever it might be that's keeping them out, and actually break it all down and say, you know, one piece of music for every single day of the year, you've got this. And actually we've got the technology now to make sure that it's opened up to everyone, but it can be hard to know where to begin. And I love that you picked up on the folk element, because as I was researching the book, as I was writing it, so often this comes up. Either that people are trying to really get to the roots of what their own musical tradition is, mm-hmm. and perhaps incorporate that into the classical sort of strictures, or they're emulating the folk traditions from other cultures and other communities. And it's so interesting to see those connections be made.
We have one more.
Well, I started off with my homeboy, Henry Purcell, but I thought this week we had to have a nod to one of the American greats. This is the week that acknowledges the anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And on the 25th of November, so coming up this Sunday, that was the anniversary of Kennedy's funeral. And apparently this was his favourite piece of music. So Jackie Kennedy convened the National Symphony Orchestra in DC for the state funeral. of JFK, and it broadcast on the radio to millions. And it's adapted from a string quartet that Samuel Barber, who's the composer, born in 1910, actually wrote. He was only 26 when he wrote it, which just kind of stops me in my tracks. The idea that a 26-year-old, you know, so often we think, you know, what does a 26-year-old know about grief or heartbreak or any of those things? And it's so insulting because, of course, they can conjure everything, and that's what this piece does.
And he was born in 1910, so if he's 26, it was Great Depression.
Yeah, exactly. So this was written in 1936. He adapted it from the string quartet into a symphonic version, a string version, I should say. And it was also used at the funerals of Einstein, Princess Grace, and at official memorials for Diana, Princess of Wales, as well as the victims of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. In a way, it's become a shorthand for a sorrow that is unutterable, that can't be expressed through any other means. But it was also radiant and redemptive in that sorrow. So here we are, JFK's favourite piece of music. It is the Adagio for Strings by Samuel Barber.
Oh, it's lovely.
All the goosebumps, right?
Yeah, it's lovely. Lovely.
Well, he was a genius, Samuel Barber, and, you know, I think just to be able to sum up what he sums up in that piece of music. And, you know, that's quite well known. It's also been used in film soundtracks and Platoon, among many others. And for me, it just reinforces this idea that actually the music itself can be very directly and emotionally affecting to anyone. And people tend to respond to music like that, even if they think they have no engagement with classical music. And so that's my kind of constant mission in the book, to just say, this music can do it for you too, whoever you are.
Mission accomplished for this week.
Thank you very much.
Clemency Burton Hill, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up next, the author of a New York Magazine piece called The Watcher, about a family stalked by creepy, incessant, and anonymous letters sent to their Westfield home. Stay with us. We'll be back after a quick break. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. What would you do if the house of your dreams was being watched by a complete stranger who liked to send you letters detailing what they saw about you, about the house, about your kids? Would you risk it all to live in the place you loved, or would you turn your back on your dream home? This was precisely the situation one New Jersey family found themselves in 2014 when they purchased a grand old home in Westfield, New Jersey, known as 657 Boulevard. Shortly after the sale, they received a letter asking questions like, "Do you need to fill the house with the young blood I requested?" And, "Was it greed to bring me your children? Once I know their names, I will call to them and draw them to me." What would you do if your family was threatened in such a way? Here to explain this petrifying, creepy, and odd story, that's fair, right, Reeves?
I think all those adjectives apply.
Is New York Magazine contributing editor Reeves Wideman. His recent piece in The Cut is titled The Watcher, which is how these letters were actually signed.
I know, yeah.
Okay, so Reeves, this story has been in and out of the local news for a couple of years, and we'll talk about why.
Sure.
But this is one of the first times the family has really explained what's been going on in detail to you. First of all, why did they think that this was the right time?
I'm not sure there was ever a right time, but when this story sort of first became public, they chose not to speak. They didn't want to put their kids in the spotlight, and I think they felt at this point their story hadn't been told, and for a variety of reasons, they kind of wanted to have that story heard.
All right, so let's just set the stage. Westfield, I know Westfield because I grew up in Glen Ridge. We used to play in football.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
So Westfield is this quintessential upper middle class suburban town. Mm-hmm. Who lives there? Sort of median income. What's the classic Westfielder?
Sure, you know, I mean, Westfielders would say there's lots of different Westfielders, but by and large, it's a fairly affluent community. Bloomberg put it in the top 100 richest communities in America. It's generally families. It's a very family friendly sort of idyllic suburb. People refer to it as Mayberry, referring to the Andy Griffith Show. So it's kind of the exact kind of place you'd want to live.
So this family, the Brodus family, see this beautiful home. If you Google it, you can see it online. It's gorgeous.
Yeah.
Why did they pick Westfield?
Well, Maria Brodus grew up there. She grew up there her whole life. And after she and her husband, Derek, got married, they eventually moved back to the area. They lived in a neighboring town. And I think they had always, Maria in particular, had always wanted to come back to her hometown. So they'd been living in another home in Westfield and then had a growing family and needed a bigger house. And that's how they ended up here.
So we have Maria and Derek, and mm-hmm. Maria's the hometown girl.
Yep.
This is a weird question. Who would play Maria in the movie of this and who would play Derek, just so we have visuals?
Good question. You know, I am just going to give them a compliment and say it would be George Clooney and, I don't know, Jennifer Aniston's coming to mind.
Okay.
But,
we got it.
Yeah, sure.
We got it. So they buy this home. Was the original plan to move in right away and then they discovered they needed to renovate? Or how
sure.
did they started these big renovations, we should say?
Yeah, they bought the home. It's an older home. It's over 100 years old. And they bought the house, started doing renovations the next day, the day after the deal closed, doing things like installing air conditioning. They were finishing the basement. It wasn't a complete renovation, but there was some significant work that they planned on doing, and it started sort of at the beginning of the summer, and they hoped towards the end of the summer to be able to move in.
So at what point did they start, did they receive the first letter?
They received the first letter. They bought the house on a Monday. The renovation started on Tuesday, and Thursday evening, Derek Broaddus found the first letter from the Watcher in the mail.
Wow, in 4 days.
4 days. Not much had happened. You know, there were workers in the house that were referred to in the letter, but not a ton of people knew even that the house was for sale. There was never a for sale sign, so...
And the letter's tone. Can you describe mm-hmm. the letter's tone? Because the tone of the letters sort of changed over time, but initially.
Yeah, they're very unusual. They're very creepy. The person signed the letters, the Watcher, and in the letters they talk about how their family, their father, their grandfather, had watched the home since, I believe, the 1920s. So it has this kind of tone of sort of an obsession with the house. The first letter doesn't mention the Broadduses by name, and the writer seems to have know a little bit about them, but they knew how many kids they had, for instance, but not a ton. And then from there, in subsequent letters, the writer seemed to know more about the family.
So did the first letter, it didn't say to the Broadduses,
it said to the new owners, I believe, or dearest new neighbors, I believe was how it was addressed.
Wow. So had the previous tenants had this experience?
Owners. After Derek and Maria got this letter, they immediately emailed the family that sold them the home. And that family immediately responded the next day and said that, yes, a week prior to the closing on the sale, they had gotten a letter signed the Watcher, according to this family, that was sort of an odd letter, sort of thanking them for taking care of the home and passing it on to someone new. That family, you know, it was obviously an unusual thing that they discussed, but they threw the letter away. So we don't have that letter anymore.
So the previous owners didn't see the letters as threatening.
That's what they say. Yeah, and they say it was just kind of odd and strange, and you can kind of see the Broaddus' letter, sort of the letters they received, becoming more and more threatening. But they say that was the only letter they had, this other family had received, and they'd lived in the house for 23 years, and they say, you know, nothing else unusual had happened.
So after the first letter arrives, what do the Broadduses do?
They immediately call the police. It's the first thing that happens that night. They go into the station the next day. And are told, you know, don't talk about this. We are going to look into this. And at that point, they're on high alert. Derek Broaddus cancels a work trip. Whenever they go, they're sort of going over to the house to kind of move boxes in. And, you know, Maria Broaddus, when she brings her kids, she's kind of yelling at them to make sure they kind of stay close. So they're still hopeful they're going to move in, but they're on high alert.
But it's interesting. Her yelling at her kids may have been a catalyst for the watcher to write again.
It's possible. The second letter, it does mention them by name. It's their last name. It's misspelled. It's possible the watcher kind of heard someone saying their name. And then in that letter, I believe they also say, you know, something to the effect of you say your children's names a lot. So it does seem that whoever wrote this letter could have heard that.
We're talking to Reese Wideman about his piece, The Watcher, that's in New York Magazine, about this strange stalking of a family home in Westfield, New Jersey. So what did the police do? Did they just start interviewing the neighbors? Do they have a sense of what's the protocol on stalking letters?
It's really unusual. You know, the Westfield Police is a small town police department. They deal with a variety of crimes, but this would be an odd case for any police department to deal with, particularly a smaller one. Very quickly there was an initial suspect who was kind of a guy on the neighborhood that everyone knew to be sort of odd. He lived next door. For a variety of reasons, it seemed possible that he could be the suspect, and so the initial investigation kind of focused there.
What flavor of odd?
He would kind of do unusual things. I spoke to his family. He was, as a young man, diagnosed with schizophrenia. People would tell me, you know, knew people would move into the neighborhood, and they would see him kind of walk through their backyard, which obviously is kind of unusual. And then as they got to know him, he'd walk through their backyard and tell them, oh, you know, you have termites back there, or something like that. He was kind of a helpful, kind person, but obviously someone that, you know, to newcomers, you know, seemed kind of unusual.
So as the police start to interview the neighbors, because in these letters, the watcher, and one of them mentions, I think, an art easel, starts mentioning very specific things going on in the house, the neighbors initially are, you know, feel bad for them, but they start to turn on the family a little bit. Can you explain why?
Sure. Well, one thing that's worth noting is the police didn't really talk to many of the neighbors early on. They kind of had this initial focus. I think to some degree they, you know, it's nothing had happened. I think they probably kind of hoped this was just going to go away. Once they did, a year later, kind of went back as news of this story broke, they went back and investigated. Some of the neighbors very quickly jumped on this idea that the Broaddus family had written the letters to themselves. The sort of conspiracy theories are that they couldn't afford the house, and this was kind of the cockamamie scheme that they came up with to try to do that, or there was some kind of scam they were running. The theories didn't quite make sense, but I was really surprised by how many people, even within Westfield, seemed to believe this.
And we should point out at this point that Derek is really starting to unhinge a little bit. Too strong, but he's really becoming unmoored over this.
I mean, this whole thing, you know, destroyed their family's lives. For one thing, they bought a house that they can't live
house.
In. Yeah, or they've chosen not to live in because they have three young kids, and you don't want to take the bet that this person is going to go from letter writing to something else. They moved in with their in-laws. They spent tons of money and time trying to figure this out for themselves, investigating any kind of suspicious lead. When they went to the grocery store, you're seeing kind of people look at your kids that, you know, are probably just normal looks, but when you're on this kind of have this heightened alertness, it kind of takes over your whole life.
So Derek hires private investigators.
Investigator, an FBI profiler.
Yeah. You know, you start thinking CSI,
sure.
Westfield.
Yeah.
There's got to be DNA somewhere. Why wasn't there any DNA on the letters?
Well, there was. There was a DNA that was found, and we don't know too much about that evidence. But for one thing, the this was reported in the local paper at one point, they tested, Maria Broaddus gave a sample, and
they thought it was a woman, right?
They thought it was a woman. Right. And the one thing that we've learned is, and this was reported in the local paper, was that the DNA was female.
So for a while, the family, the Broaddus family, kept this quiet.
Mm-hmm.
But how did it leak to the media?
They kept it quiet for a year. For a couple of reasons. They wanted to protect their kids from more attention. The police asked them to, because the suspects were kind of all around them. And they tried to sell the house. They tried to sell the house, and one thing they decided to do was, we're not going to sell this house and not tell people about these letters. Their plan was if kind of the offers got far enough, they would show people the letters. Even kind of the early disclosures that were kind of vague of something weird had happened seemed to kind of push buyers away. A year after the fact, they filed a legal complaint against the previous owners, arguing that they should have told the Broadduses about the previous letter, that it's what's known as a transient social condition, that they should have reported in the same way you might report, lead paint or other problems with the foundation or whatnot.
Because at this point, they have to be feeling the financial strain.
Yeah, it kind of was devastating to them. You know, Derek has a good job. But buying a million-dollar house and paying the mortgage and the taxes, and they kept up the landscaping in this nice neighborhood. All of that kind of built up.
Now, when did the police? You mentioned that they came back a year later. Mm-hmm. They circled back a year later. Why?
So the lawsuit was filed, or the complaint was filed, and a local reporter in New Jersey found the complaint. It had some quotes from the letters. It sort of went viral briefly. The Broadduses chose not to talk to the media at that point. But at that point, there was a lot of pressure locally. A lot of neighbors kind of said, hey, you didn't talk to us about this. Why not? And so that kind of reinvigorated the police investigation.
And as we mentioned earlier, there was sort of this weird dynamic that happened in the town where mm-hmm. they sort of turned on the Broaddus family and said, you guys, you did this to self. And Derek did something odd, which mm-hmm. he admitted to you in this piece. Tell mm-hmm. me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, basically, as mentioned, there were a lot of people in the town. Even I was kind of looking on local Facebook pages, and people thought even people that lived in the neighborhood thought this was some conspiracy. And at one point, the Broadduses filed an application to try to tear the house down, which is something that has become very common in places like Westfield, mm-hmm. tearing old homes down. They were going to build two new houses, sell it to a developer at a loss, but enough of a loss for them to manage. But that kind of built even more. People were like, oh, here's another example of they must be just trying to make a quick buck off of this. All of that, seeing your neighbors, at one point one of their neighbors said, this couple should be tarred and feathered. And this was a guy who lived, three or four blocks down. I think the stress really built up on them. Derek Broaddus eventually did last year send letters to those, a couple of people who had been commenting online, suggesting this was all a conspiracy. And, basically telling them, it's not, you're causing harm to my family. He signed it anonymously, Friends of the Broaddus Family, which, given the context of what happened in this neighborhood, obviously kind of, freaked those people out. But, it did to kind of sit there and watch people talk about your family that way, maybe not the best means, but you can kind of understand how you might be driven to that.
And the Watcher's letters, they became sort of erratic. I'm going to read part of this. The Watcher wrote to them, "I will fend off bad things and wait for it to become good again about the house. It will not punish me. I will rise again. I will be patient and wait for this to pass. Let the young blood sleep in 657 Boulevard. Stop changing it. Let it alone."
Mm-hmm.
It's just seems too crazy a story for someone to do this to themselves.
Why would you destroy your lives? You know, I've often asked people, what's the motive? And no one can come up with anything. Why would basically, literally, this kind of destroyed their lives. They're doing better the further they get away from this. But it just doesn't make any sense.
But as I said to my producer earlier this morning, we've seen the GoFundMe campaign of this veteran and these two people who raised $400,000 supposedly of this good deed of veteran. They turned out to be enormous scammers, all three of them. He was the veteran, but they scammed people out of $400,000 with this feel-good story. So I remember thinking about that and thinking about this piece. I was like, you know, people can do really weird things. Did you get any sense that there was just something else going on?
You know, I'm a reporter. I'm obviously always looking for something being off. The moment I met Derek and Maria and sat in their living room, and I've since spent many hours with them, they are not the kind of people, they're not calculating people. They could not be a more normal family with sweet kids that is just trying to live a peaceful suburban life. So if they've pulled this off, they've duped me, but seems unlikely to me.
It's a fascinating story. The name of it is The Watcher. It's a New York magazine. Reese Wyman, thank you so much for sharing your reporting with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
This is all of it on WNYC. We'll see you after the news.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.